Welcome to the Protocols webinar series presented by the Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section and the Association of Moving Image Archivists. This is webinar number 3, Providing Context Through Centering Indigenous Voices, hosted by Jennifer O'Neill, with guest interview of the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project team, June 2020. We would like to acknowledge our sponsors and partners for this specific webinar, the Society of American Archivists, the Sustainable Heritage Network, and the Association of Moving Image Archivists. We also want to acknowledge the Society of American Archivists Native American Archives section, who is specifically coordinating and hosting this webinar series. By following this link here to our webpage, you can find additional information about the webinar series and the protocols. For this Protocols webinar series, each webinar session will cover one or more of the 10 core sections of the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials, which establishes best practices for the culturally responsive care and use of Native American archival materials, particularly materials that are housed in non-tribal institutions. An entire link to the document can be found by following this link, which is hosted at Northern Arizona University. Here we list the 10 core sections of the protocols. In previous webinars, we've touched on building relationships of mutual respect, striving for balance in content and perspectives, accessibility and use, and culturally sensitive materials. This webinar series particularly touches on the issue of providing context. In the future webinar series, we will touch on further additional core sections of the protocols. Today's webinar series, episode number 3, Providing Context, again is hosted by Jennifer O'Neill with guests from the Tribe Sourcing Southwest Film Project team. Included on the team are Jennifer Jenkins, Principal Investigator, University of Arizona, Melissa Dolman, Project Manager, University of North Carolina PhD student, Yankton Sioux descent, Rhiannon Sorrell, Dene, Instruction and Digital Services Librarian at Dene College, Crystal Littleben, Dene, Program Coordinator, Navajo Cultural Arts Program. As part of episode number 3, this includes an in-depth conversation with the entire Tribe Sourcing Southwest Films Project team. In the webinar, we highlight the project and discuss the following topics: overview of the American Indian Film Gallery collection housed at the University of Arizona, specifically how the project Tribe sources mid-20th century educational and sponsored films about Native peoples of the U.S. Southwest by recording Native narrations and contextual information for film content from the Native communities they represent, how the project seeks to enhance, contextualize, and reinterpret valuable historic visual imagery when the original narrations are often inaccurate and culturally uninformed, strategies and steps involved in building relationships with local tribal community partners in providing context, and major lessons learned when building relationships and partnerships with Native American tribes and individuals. The team also specifically shows the website that they have built, which is on the Mercadoo platform. So we link here. This is their direct site, which you can also go and explore. You can browse by community, digital heritage, their dictionary, specific lessons plans, and any news that they have about the project as well. So we highly encourage you, after you watch this webinar, to go and explore their site to see the amazing work that they have completed on this project. As part of the interview and webinar series today, they also show, and we will end with, specific highlights from two different films. First is The Navajo Silversmith from 1959. And in showing these, we also encourage you to go directly to these films so that you can explore them yourselves. But we wanted to be able to show specifically the amazing aspect of this project. So as part of these films, we encourage you to both watch the film And then simultaneously, you also play the audio recording that's shown below the film. The audio recording is the new information and narrations that have been completed as part of this project. So here we give instructions on how to actually play the video and audio simultaneously so that you can hear the new narration along with seeing the original film. The other film included is The Arts and Crafts of the Southwest Indians from 1953. Similarly, we encourage you to go and watch this film and listen to the new narration. And then also below the film, in the metadata section, there's new narration and an overview of the film. So both provide the context that is needed and the new narration and history that's provided for these films, which is incredible. We also encourage you to follow us and send us questions on social media through Facebook and Twitter. We've linked both of those pages here, so we highly encourage you to send us questions after you've watched the webinar, and we will engage with you to answer as many of those questions as possible. A major project we're working on as part of this webinar series, after we are completed with additional webinars throughout this year, we will also be creating a protocols implementation toolkit to provide you with the necessary tools for implementing the protocols in your own institution. Please look for that forthcoming in fall 2020 and will be developed over the course of the webinar series. We hope you enjoy this webinar and we look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome everyone. This is the third in the series for the Society of American Archivists Protocols webinars. I'm Jennifer O'Neill. I'm the host for this series, and we're so excited to have you here today. I am a member of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde in Oregon. I am also a professor at the University of Oregon in Native Studies, and also one of the original drafters of the Protocols for Native American Archival Materials. So I'm delighted to be able to host this webinar series. And through this series, we do this so that we can share some amazing projects that have been happening with Native American archives in working with source communities and with non-tribal repositories, showing how we can bring together and have successful relationships and partnerships and collaborations. So this series is really meant to bring together and to celebrate a lot of those collaborations. And so I'm so excited to be able to bring together some amazing people today who have been working on a project over the last several years, and they're going to be sharing that project with you. This project is called Tribe Sourcing, and it is a project that originated out of a collection at the University of Arizona. And the four people that I have here today are Jennifer Jenkins from the University of Arizona, Melissa Dolman from the University of North Carolina, Rhiannon Sorrell from Diné College, and Crystal Littleben from the Navajo Cultural Arts Program. And today, they're going to share with you the project that they've been working on and how they've connected with community partners, how they have created this program to assist with this collection. And the other thing I wanted to note with this project and the webinar today, not only is this hosted and supported and sponsored by the Society of American Archivists, but is also supported by AMIA, the Association of Moving Image Archivists. And it's through this partnership that we're bringing this webinar to you today. And so we're really delighted that we could work on this partnership in conjunction with both of these organizations to really highlight these collaborations, as well as how these groups are trying to bring about respectful relationships through moving image archives. So to start with, I'd love to have each of the individuals with me today introduce themselves quickly before we get started on some questions. So let's start with Jennifer.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Jenkins. I'm, as Jennifer O'Neill said, at the University of Arizona, where I'm a professor of literature and film studies. And I also have an appointment in the Southwest Center, which is dedicated to the plural cultures of the Southwest US and Northern Mexico. I'm project director on the Tribe Sourcing film project.
And Melissa Dolman?
Hi, I'm Melissa Dolman. I am a PhD candidate at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm an unenrolled member of the Yankton Sioux Tribe, and I'm the project manager for the Tribe Sourcing Southwest film project, and I'm also on the board of directors for EMEA, the co-host, co-sponsor.
And Rhiannon?
Hello, yet a Sherry and Sorrel Initia, Kimichin in the Schnell Tanis and Eva Shishin, Tohiglini, the Shedona Kidne, the Schnelle, she a con not social tabahog on the Net College, but not Shinish. I'm the Instruction and Digital Services Librarian here at the Net College, and I'm also the Dine coordinator for the Dine Films of the project.
Thanks everyone for your wonderful introductions and just giving us a little bit more information about who you are. We also may be joined later by Crystal Littleben from the Navajo Cultural Arts Program. And when she's able to join us, we'll have her introduce herself as well. But to start with, we want to hear about how this project started, a little bit more about the collection, how it really started off. And then we'll go into more about actually how this whole actual project collaborated together with the tribal communities. But Jennifer, if you can share a little bit with us about really how this all started, how the collection came about, and really how this all began, so that our listeners have a little bit more context and information.
Sure. So this is a collection that was amassed by a professor who was a history professor at Northern Illinois University. Fred McDonald was originally from Cap Breton, Nova Scotia, and became a medieval and Renaissance history professor, not a Native Studies professor at all. And he realized in the late 70s that school and library collections of educational, industrial, and tourist films were beginning to go into dumpsters because those public facilities were starting to upgrade or update their media resources to VHS, you know, the next new great thing. So he started salvaging, really. I mean, in some cases he bought up the collections, but in many cases he just either fished them out of dumpsters or had people donate to him and amass these collections. So this particular subset of his huge collection is dedicated to films about, and some by, but mostly about Native peoples of the Americas. And he was able to find films that go from, you know, Nunavut on the Arctic Circle all the way down to Tierra del Fuego on the tip of South America. So he had this wonderful archive in a warehouse in Chicago, and when he got ready to retire, he put out a call for proposals for stewardship of the collection, and the University of Arizona's proposal was successful. You know, Arizona is home to 22 federally recognized tribes and over 250,000 Native citizens, and reservations and tribal communities occupy over a quarter of Arizona's land. So, you know, we have a good context for this. So the collection came to us in 2011, and what we got was a kind of rudimentary digital archive. He had scanned the films and that was it. Put them into a kind of very rudimentary site, and he sent that to us, and then we had to figure out what to do with it. And you know, the U of A didn't want to just host a static website. We wanted to adapt the collection as a kind of educational resource for Indigenous and non-Indigenous communities. And, you know, these are really interesting films. Many of them are very beautiful. They were made during the golden age of 16 millimeter Kodachrome filmmaking. But the narrations are often quite anchored in mid-century or earlier attitudes. And so we say that those are from the dark ages of misunderstanding and misinformation. So what would be a way to adapt this to a 21st century use? And what seemed like the logical thing to do was to take the films back into the communities where they were made and invite community members to narrate the films, re-narrate the films, address the misinformation that's in them, identify specific locations and perhaps people and practices that are recorded on these films. And I want to say right away that at the time that this project came to us, I was working sort of as a shared faculty member in our School of Information and using the protocols in my Introduction to Archives courses. So the protocols really are the ethos of this whole project, that we need to connect with Native communities and consult with them. And luckily, the National Endowment for the Humanities funded us for a three-year project to begin this process of tribe sourcing with our nearest neighbors, tribes in Arizona and New Mexico.
Great, thank you. That gives us such a good context to know not only more about the collection itself, but also what the goals were of the project as you received the collection and then moving into actually making it accessible, but doing it in the culturally appropriate way in reaching out to communities, selecting some that to do that work with, and as well as working it into your curriculum that you were doing as well. So that's great to hear. I just want to acknowledge, thank you, Crystal. Little Ben is now here. Thank you for joining us. We had just went around to introduce ourselves quickly, so I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself, let us know a little bit about you and your role in the project, and then I'll ask a few more questions of you later as well too, but just want to acknowledge you're here and make sure you got a chance to introduce yourself.
Okay. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Yat em. My name is Crystal Littleben. Kintlachitni nishlim, ma'idesh gijni, bashishchin, vipatwone, dashiche ato, bitane, dashinelet. And I am originally from Tuba City, Arizona, but I currently reside here in Salie, Arizona. I work at the community college, Dene College, and I'm the program coordinator for a grant funded program, which is the Navajo Culture Arts. So thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. We can't wait to hear more about your role in this project. Just thank you so much for being here. The next question I had, bouncing off of and building upon just knowing more about the collection, what your goals were as you moved into doing the project. I know a big part of doing this project was ensuring that you were implementing culturally appropriate descriptions, metadata, and just building a system that would accommodate that and to center tribal and traditional knowledge in the films. So Melissa, if you can walk us through a little bit about your role in the project, as well as how you and others as part of the project really tried to build out a platform that centered tribal communities and their voices in this project.
Sure. Part of the reason why we chose Mercadoo, of course, is that it allows for easier logistical implementation of the protocols and their implementation of their traditional knowledge or TK labels. So each Native community represented on the site can restrict or leave open what should be seen and by whom, because Mercadoo requires that all assets be assigned to a community. And then within that community, they can apply restrictions that they handily also call protocols. So it keeps reminding people back about the sort of the theoretical in the practical on the site. So that's one of the reasons why we chose that, besides it also having been produced initially by a tribal community. But so that's some of the specific ways that the platform itself helps with that.
Great, thank you so much. That's helpful. And then what did you also do? I know you had a really important role with setting up just the metadata and setting up the back end for that. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and how you tried to work to ensure that that was culturally respectful, and just more about your role with the project?
Sure. Let's start from something that they call a digital heritage page. And so what I would do is bring in, and I can go into more details about how we do this, but once we implement and put a video file into a page itself, and then we're able to sort of populate, what protocols adhere to these, what communities belong to, and then assign keywords. And I do a thing called shot listing, which is a term that sort of just tells you in the least subjective terms as one can as a human being, sort of what's happening on the page, on the film, but on the page you can sort of read it, scan through for ADA purposes, for being more accessible to the sight impaired readers, can sort of help tease out what's on the page before you stop and then listen to the alternate narrations. And it also implements a dictionary. So all the keywords and a lot of the words that can, that some keywords that come up out of the shot listing, sort of identifying what's happening on the screen. Then once I do that, I go back, with a sort of batch. And in this case, I went to Rhiannon for the Navajo films and said, would you look over the keywords, add your own? Is there anything about what I'm describing, in the blandest terms possible, what's happening here? And then the counter narrations themselves are a form of metadata. It's a kind of natural language data. It's a kind of response. It's the additional sort of tagging that might happen in a textual environment, but it's oral.
Great, thank you. That helps to give us a little bit more background about what it actually entails in uploading the different films. As you mentioned, a big part of this was your work in connection with bringing Rhiannon in, as well as later Crystal. And so Rhiannon, can you tell us a little bit more about your role in the project, how you came to work on the project, what your role has been? And of course, this is such an important part of this project in bringing in the connection with tribal community partners and the traditional knowledge, which is really such a central part of this project. So really excited to hear about your role and your narration project. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been involved with the films all the way back to when I was an undergrad at the University of Rhode Island. I actually did my professional field experience virtually with Jennifer. And we back then it was still very static on the old website. And my job was to create research guides and curriculum guides. My field is in information literacy. So I made course guides to those, a few of those films back then. And when I moved back to the Navajo Nation and started working for Dinette College, that's when Jennifer started working on the grant proposal to NEH. And she reached out to me and asked me to do the demo. Oh, she explained the project to me, and we did a demo, and we wanted to go forward with securing narrators. So I wrote part of the letters of intent to NEH because I knew there were several collaborators here right off the bat that I would like to work with at Dinette College. One of them was definitely the DPI, which is the Dinette Policy Institute, which is based here at the college, and then working with the NAN instructors, and I knew of a few community members that would be interested. And then, of course, around the time, that's when Navajo Cultural Arts Program also started to get its feet on the ground, and I noticed that a lot of movies, a lot of the films had to do with cultural arts. They were always depicting like weaving, silversmithing, some aspect of those, so I knew cultural arts would be a great partner with this project as well. So, I knew that the project was going to be something that I wanted to be a part of because as an instruction librarian, I'm always talking about authority, and I know the strong focus in academics is like written authority, book materials,
I always heard instructors that weren't familiar with teaching Indigenous students, asking them to cite their sources from print materials. But, you know, coming from an Indigenous background, I know a lot of our authority doesn't necessarily come from print materials. It comes from oral history. It comes from non-print materials. So I definitely want to be involved in this project, which involved correcting the records on all of these, you know, films. A lot of them had a very, you know, disrespectful background, outdated language, from an outside Eurocentric anthropological perspective. So I knew I wanted to be part of that process of, you know, correcting the record.
And so I know a big part of the project was actually creating new narrations for some of the films. Mm-hmm. Can maybe you tell us a little bit about what was one of your favorite ones to work on, or what was that experience like just developing new narrations for the film?
Yeah, you know, it was kind of off to a rocky start because I myself had my own way of going about it. But, you know, as I start going to different narrators, every narrator had their different understanding about it. They would kind of have their own take on it. And, you know, one of the first recordings I did do, among one of the first, was with one of our former librarians here who has been here since the college, around the time of the college first was established. And so she had a lot of, you know, oral history type stuff. She and her husband came in and, you know, they did the entire narration in Navajo. And then, you know, right after that, I had another couple come in. They were closer to my age, a younger couple that came in, and their take was very different. They talked about it like they were making some sort of audio commentary on any kind of film. Like they joked about how, like, we don't watch movies with us because we're constantly pausing and talking about it. And that's what they did. They were watching a film. There are films that were only 12 minutes long, but their audio commentary ran over an hour and 20 minutes because they were constantly stopping the films and they wanted to talk about various things they were seeing. And it was interesting to see the goals of each narrator change. One group would, you know, really want to focus on straight up facts, like that's that building that's in Window Rock, that's, you know, what you call this. And then there were others that were saying, well, you know, this is time from long ago that, you know, if I wanted to talk about this to my children or future generations, this is what I want to say to them about these films. So even the audiences that the narrators were recording their commentary for, they were changing with each different recording, with each different narrator.
Wow, that's so interesting to hear that you had such different narrations that could happen just based upon age or background. I'm assuming that is very similar what happens in many tribal communities, though, when you do have varying perspectives or context based upon somebody's background, their families, how they connect with certain time periods in history. So I think that's important to point out because that is something that I know happens very frequently, or even just in general questions about, well, who should I talk to in a tribal community? Whose perspective should I get? Every perspective is different and unique based upon their experience, but that also is what makes it important. So I think it's really important to point that out, which is really great. Let's move on to, I'd love to get to have Crystal talk a little bit about her experience as well. So can you tell us a little bit about when you came into the project and also what your role was? Because it's just so great to hear this side of the project and what your role has been.
Okay.
There you are.
Okay. Again, so I work for the Navajo Culture Arts Program here at Diné College, and as a coordinator, a lot of my responsibilities is to take care of our certificate program, but also now our BFA program, and a lot of our courses and our degree programs, they're very hands-on with our culture arts. So we offer courses in moccasin making, Navajo silversmithing, Navajo weaving, Navajo basket weaving, and then recently Navajo pottery making. So with that, being with this program for a little over 3 years, I've got to have hands-on experience and to gain more knowledge within all of these cultural arts, and also picking up one of the cultural arts along the way, which is Navajo silversmithing, and that's something that I carry on to this day. And also a lot of my family members, especially my dad and my mother. My father knows how to make moccasins, and my mother, she used to weave, and it goes back, you know, that intergenerational transfer of knowledge, that's what is in a lot of our Navajo families. So my grandparents, my grandmother, you know, they were Navajo weavers and everything like that. And so having this knowledge already, but also working for the Navajo Culture Arts Program, it broadened my knowledge and all of that. And so when Rhiannon, we work with Rhiannon closely, especially with the library, with our Navajo Culture Arts First Friday workshop series. We host workshop series, free workshops at the Diné College library locations. So we've done sewing workshops, we've done beading workshops for the community, and it's open to anyone. And so that's how we work with the library. And then in Rhiannon, she asked me if I could do some narration. So that's my role within this project, is that I became a narrator. And she gave me some links to look at for these videos. And so while I looked at them and looking at the narration that was already with the films, in a way, you know, it was funny. At the same time, it was inaccurate. And I was like, oh my goodness. And as I started going through the website and looking at all of the other videos, I know that before Rhiannon and I, we used to always, we still talk about this, and we're like, oh my gosh, like, should I be viewing some of these videos? Some of these shouldn't even be, you know, to the public. And so I think that it is crucial to have community members to take part in this project, because they're the ones that grew up on the reservation. They're the ones that have family members who do these cultural arts, who tell them all of these stories. And so for me, in some of the films, I recognize locations. And so during the narrations, I was like, okay, I was like, I know where this is at. I was like, I know where they're herding sheep. And my favorite video that I narrated was an Navajo silversmithing, because during that time, during the narration, I was also still learning how to do tufa casting work. And in that specific video, they were doing tufa casting, they were carving in the tufa. And so that's what I was really excited about that. And so that's what I think is very important, that, you know, that community members play a huge part in these narrations, because we get to take back, you know, our culture, we get to take back our history, our culture arts, and explain it the way we grew up. What we grew up with, and with our own knowledge. And I like how Rhiannon said that one of her first narrations were in Navajo, and I would, you know, that would be really good to see and to hear about, because our elders, you know, they have a lot of knowledge still, and there's that barrier within a lot of Native communities, is that language barrier. So just to have that to have those archived, I think that's very important. So this opportunity has opened a lot of doors for me, and, you know, it kind of helped me put my knowledge and my experience into another opportunity. So, and I even got to go to Baltimore, which was a really awesome experience, and the feedback that we got, it was really awesome to experience. So
Thank you so much, Crystal, for sharing that with us. That gives us such a good perspective on what it's actually like for a tribal community partner to come in and work on a project like this, which, as you said, is the most important thing to a project like this, is bringing in that traditional Native knowledge, but also the Native language, particularly for so many communities that have language loss or are looking for any opportunities to preserve that. Being able to do it in this way, not only sharing of history and correcting inaccuracies, but then also bringing in the tribal language, being able to do all of that is so important. And that's what I think is so unique about this project, is that not only is it an amazing collection of visual materials, but the way that the tribal communities are now taking back the tribal knowledge and ensuring the tribal knowledge is correct, but also adding in the tribal language. That's what's really so unique about this project, and ensuring that tribal community partners like both of you have that chance to add that knowledge and information. And it's also great because one thing at least I see is that in addition to this original collection, it's also in essence creating almost like a brand new collection because it's going back to the community in some way, and it's also building up new knowledge, and it's helping tribal elders or new tribal members, or I mean younger tribal members, to reconnect with their history in maybe a different way. So it's like the second stage of whatever had been created having a new purpose. So that's also just really great to hear that this is a way that this collection continues to grow, to evolve. So in light of that, and just building off this amazing work that you've already done, what are some of maybe the next steps that you all have for the project, or what are some next exciting things that you're working on? And anybody can answer or address that.
I was just going to say something about the films themselves that that Crystal was referring to, a conference where we all met, and all of us actually met in some capacity. And some of the great feedback that we got was that a lot of times these films, which kind of went into the public domain, were shown in classrooms, sometimes on television, that that they were just out there. But as archivists, like MacDonald, who originally collected these, that they don't necessarily, they have kind of, well, awful kitsch value, you know, beautiful. We already contextualized why they're problematic, but we got some really good feedback about putting them to use as a way, like putting them, not just having them hanging out there in the world, but actually activating them in a way by putting them back in the community, eliciting these new narrations. And it was, that's just coming from an archivist point of view, that they're not just these static objects, well, digital objects now, but also literal objects in storage, the actual films that can have a new life in this way, and a corrected life.
Yeah, and that's a word. What I was alluding to is, this second phase of this collection, and I'm sure that's probably one of your goals, or maybe you can clarify that at least. One thing I would see, or even just seeing what I have with the collection, is it's such a great educational tool to be used for curriculum or in community or just in any educational setting. And so I'd be curious to know, particularly from Rhiannon and Crystal, how you see these films being used and what, not only in your community, but maybe also educationally, how would you prefer to see them used, or what's a good goal to have for these films?
Yeah, absolutely. I am, like I said, my background is in information literacy and in teaching, nonfiction, all of that interdisciplinary area. But, you know, like I said, I started out with Jennifer, you know, creating course plans, curriculum guides with the films before we did the narration. Now that we have narrations, I would really like them to see going more into this information literacy towards course guides. But there's also been a lot of interest around using them as tools in the language classroom. A lot of people talked about, you know, it'd be really great to show these in K-12 Navajo language immersion programs, being able to narrate them in Navajo, being able to use them as study guides in Navajo. So I think as far as going forward, you know, if it's not, you know, creating critical conversation about, you know, correcting the record and reclaiming the films, I think the further steps would be actually utilizing these films in, again, language revitalization. And Crystal will be able to speak more toward this idea of the intergenerational transfer of knowledge that these can be used for. Again, visual materials are in high demand. There's definitely been this push to move away from quote unquote book learning because, you know, the Navajo language itself is not traditionally written. So, you know, having an ear for it, being able to hear it a lot, being able to, you know, engage with it in that way, both, you know, through hearing and I think through the visual depictions that these films have, I think they can be utilized in that way as a teaching aid.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Crystal, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. In addition to it being a part of the curriculum and also but also for, I think, for college students, for higher education, but including our program and Navajo Culture Arts program, we recently started a Navajo Culture Arts language series. And what that is we put out a video every week regarding, there's a theme every month. And say there's a month that's Navajo silversmithing, every week we put out a new video and it's more of a learning, language learning video, and we have vocabulary, we have narration, we also have comprehension questions at the end for elementary. My father is a Navajo language instructor here at Dinette College as well, and he said that he's able to use these videos as well to show to the students to see if they're able to transcribe, because Dinette College has the upper Navajo language courses, and a part of those upper language courses is there's transcribing involved. So he said that he could use these videos to where the students can transcribe these videos into Navajo, and that could be something that you guys could set up with all local communities, is that you can have students transcribe these videos into the native language. Another thing as well is for these videos, they could be lesson plans are great too. Lesson plans, I think that's a really great idea to have these videos. And also there was another thing that I was thinking about. What was the other one for these videos? So a lot of the videos, they're older, and it showcases the processing of how they did all the cultural arts back then. And I think that's very important to know, because nowadays there are companies that are selling tools and materials that are already made or that are already processed, and we don't know the process between what they used to do back then. So I think it's really amazing to see that in these videos, is that our people, they already knew how to do that, and that's what it's already documented. So I think that's what is another great way to use these videos, is to let the students see that this is how, you know, we made, you know, wool. This is how we process wool. This is how we did tufa casting. This is how you make a hogan. This is how a wedding is conducted. So there's a lot of ways to utilize these videos, especially with this with education with the students, no matter how old. Also, so yeah.
Can I just add something?
Yeah, go ahead, Jennifer.
Quickly, thanks. Yeah. I just wanted to give a shout out to Mukadoo because it has a dictionary function, and Melissa has had a lot of fun with Rhiannon's help generating Navajo language vocabulary associated with these different films. And I think that's a really nice value added dimension of the Mukadoo platform that it's possible to do that. And I'll just hand it over to Melissa to talk about that and Rhiannon a little bit more.
Oh, it's certainly been an exercise in research for me. It's been, obviously, I want folks to double check the work and verify and fact check. But yeah, that function's really great. And so the Dana College one, the Apache language, I was able to get a little bit of assistance from our narrators so far. So I'm really looking forward to, in fact, maybe in the next iteration, handing off the dictionary to interns or people from the community who want to take that up as an assignment, because certainly I shouldn't be the one populating it wholly, but it's certainly been a good exercise. And it's so far we have a few different languages included in it. I think it's an excellent, and now I want to talk to Crystal, I want to talk to your dad and see if he wants to start implementing this as a project, if he's interested.
Yeah, Melissa's done a great job with the dictionary. I was surprised myself because I wasn't really aware of this function. So when I started seeing all these keywords popping up on the side panel, I was like, whoa. And the Navajo language is extremely difficult to write because it's just heavy on diacritics and glottal stops and all sorts of like nasal tones. So, you know, unless you grew up learning how to work with it, you know, I went to Dine Bolotkhan, so they really instilled that writing system into us. But there are Dine speakers that don't know how, they can speak it fluently, but they don't know how to write it. So being able to read it and write it was very helpful in the dictionary. But like I said, it was like, kind of, it blew me away to see all of that work done in the side panel. And it is a lot of work. You know, I've been working on including more written Navajo in the library, for example. And, you know, it's very, Crystal, we've talked about, had conversations about this, is just, you know, it varies. A lot of the language itself can vary by region. You know, there's different dialects too. So the way one person on one side of the res says something is not necessarily the same as somebody else on the other side of the res. And, you know, this is why I got to emphasize, you know, the project being unique to every narrator, because one narrator, well, you know, Crystal was talking about, there's a really good, you know, image of a wedding, you know, a movie of a wedding in there. But then there's always going to be someone who will say, well, you know, they did it this way, but, you know, you should do it that way. And so all of these little things are very unique to a very different part of the res. So, you know, being able to just even get started with a dictionary is a big deal, because then you got another layer of, you know, how does one person on one side of the res say it versus the other. So, yeah, that was one thing that also came up in relation to the recordings as well.
And Mercadieu is amazing in its ability to really to show the diacritics as they should be used. I think I'm not a coder, so I'm not exactly sure how it does it, but I'm able to literally, well, I have a keyboard, Deneb is a keyboard, but also I'm able to cut and paste, and it maintains the diacritics from the original textual source. And so that's pretty exciting too.
And for people who haven't worked with Mercadieu much, you know, those are searchable terms, right? Those are keywords that are searchable. So you can type in, you know, the word for sheep in all the films that engage with sheep, which is most of them, will come up. So that's a really great function.
Yeah, it's deeply hyperlinked through all the films. So one keyword will bring it up, and it allows you to put in, you know, personal names. So if I'm able to identify somebody, you know, then so there's a hoop dancer named Tony Whitecloud, and he's turned up in a few films. And so now if you click on Tony Whitecloud, you bring up all the films that he's been featured in.
Well, speaking of the site and Mercadieu and the amazing project that you've built, one thing that we wanted to end on for this series is to be able to have you show a little bit of the site, which we're going to do now. And then at the end as well, we're going to be adding on to this recording one of the videos or one of the films that have added the new narration. So we'll also add that on to the end of this. But we thought it'd be great to end with, if you can show us in sharing your screen, if you want to share a little bit of the site with us and just walk us through a little bit of the site so that for everybody watching, so that they can see it, but then they can also go and explore it for themselves, because we've been talking about this. It's good for people to visually see now what we're talking about. So Melissa, do you want to share a little bit of that with us?
Sure, I'll share a screen now. Yeah. Great, so this is the front page of tribesourcingfilm.com, which is the URL. And so here's, you know, some basic information. Up here in the lesson plans, I'll just jump in right there since we were talking about it most recently. And here we have three of the lesson plans that Rhiannon has developed and another K through 12 one from a previous team member. We've included some recording instructions, including sort of, you know, mic, field mics and sort of that, but also how to do what we're doing right now, which is to interview family members at a distance if you need to. So we have some instructions there. This is the dictionary. I guess we can look at that real quick before we kind of jump in. Let's see here. Let's just pick a language here. Most of them right now are in that language, actually. So. And what's neat here is, as you can see, even the top level of the dictionary maintains diacritic character if it starts out with a non sort of Western. I'm trying a blank on the name of that. So this is what the dictionary looks like. The browse digital heritage. It's a little. My Wi-Fi is going to be a tiny bit slow. This is just where you can see everybody's. Everybody's materials, and then they're refinable by what community they're in. Also, if you would just want to jump straight to those that have been narrated, you would want to click this completed audio narration. We have some B-roll and outtakes, which means sort of the scraps of film that didn't make it into the finished production, and those can be really rich with data, as it were, metadata about the film. And a home movie that Jennifer was able to gather from a home movie day. And then to pick, you can also search them, and I'm just going to jump to the one that Crystal, one of the ones that Crystal did. And let's see here, click on that. It's a little slow today. So this is what a digital heritage page looks like, and so you've got the original film right here, and you're able to sort of, and again, we'll be doing this at the end, as you say. So here's what the film looks like. We have some instructions here about how to you know, watch if you want, but you know, not very long. Watch it all the way through, get a sense of why we want to have these community input on correcting the history and the knowledge here, and then so what you want to do for implementing, listening to the new audio narrations is you want to turn the volume down on this, and then you can like hit play, and then hit play here, and then again, we won't go into too much. There we go. And you'll get to hear this in its entirety when we're done talking. And then it has some of the keywords that we were talking about that are hyperlinked. Including tufa casting, which was a new term for me, and now I had to go back through and say that's what the name of that stone is, and I'm listening to her narration and be able to go back and do some correcting. Also try to get the original language names for certain, like in Monument Valley, what is that called in Dene Bazad, and do some work like that. There's a summary, information about Crystal. Each narrator, this is what I call a shot list, which is this your basic neutral language about what's happening in the field, and then in the film rather, and then if I can find some additional information, for instance, the person who's featured in this film, Tom Burnside, he has been written about, so we try to include some additional information if the sources are trustworthy, and some other metadata here on the side. But I think it really takes a person kind of walking through and playing around with the site to get a real sense of how magical it is to have other voices in here on the project. Does that work for a good walkthrough?
Yeah, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome.
That helps, it gives everybody some context. So it's because it's so wonderful to see just the site itself, what you all have built through the Mercado platform, and then also how you brought in those visual materials of the films, not only their original content, but then how you've added that new narration at the bottom. And thank you so much for walking us through then how to turn the volume down, but then you listen to the correct narration at the bottom. I think this is such an amazing example and project that you all have done to really put into practice the protocols, giving the correct cultural context, ensuring that the traditional knowledge is there. And also, of course, the biggest part of this is the collaboration and the centering of tribal communities in this. And really, it's just so great to see that they're really at the forefront and the ones guiding this project as much as possible. And I'm just so excited to see what comes out of this project next, especially building out more narrations, as well as the curriculum that you all have talked about, and the different exciting things that could come out of that, not only for tribal youth, but tribal elders, for everyone, particularly related to cultural arts and different history that's being documented. So it was really great to hear about your ideas for the future. So before we close, are there any other final thoughts that you would like to add, or anything that we may have missed that you would love for people to know about this project that we haven't already covered?
Well, we're always looking to connect with tribal librarians and tribal archivists to build out the project beyond the Southwest or even further in the Southwest. So anybody who's interested, if they want to get in touch with us, they can do that. There's contact information on the tribesourcingfilm.com website. And we love getting emails from new friends out in Indian country.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping to hear, is that as part of your project, that people could contact you, or just how people could contact
you. And follow us on Twitter.
So just wanted to say, then at the end of this, we will be adding the film that, or one film that we would like to highlight as part of this. So hopefully people would get a chance to not only see that, but that they could also see, they'll be able to see a film at the end where they can actually see part of one of the narrations and see what this actually looks like and listen to the new narration. So we'll add at least a couple of those on to the end. So that's part of this programming. So I just want to say thank you all so much for not only just being here today to be part of this webinar series, but also just for the amazing amount of work you have done on this project, to do it in the right, correct, ethically way, and that you've implemented the protocols, and that it's such a great example to so many of what can be done when you go about doing it in the right way. So just thank you all so much. Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks, Melissa. Thanks, Rhiannon. And thanks, Crystal, for sharing your story, for doing this work, and for sharing this with the larger archival community and being an example of how to do this work. So thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yat e she e crystal little banny nishya kinzachini nishle maidish gijni bashishin bipatoni dashache auto but ane dashanele. I'm originally from Tuba City, but I grew up in Round Rock, Arizona. I'm currently the program coordinator for the Navajo Cultural Arts Program here at Diné College. And what we do is that we run three programs right now, which is a certificate program, a dual credit program, and now a Bachelor of Fine Arts program. So a lot of the emphasis that we have are moccasin making, basket weaving, Navajo weaving, and Navajo silversmithing. which is why I chose this video to narrate, because it'll be covering about Navajo silversmithing. And I'm currently in the Bachelor of Fine Arts program, in the emphasizing in the Navajo silversmithing. And I'm in my first semester right now, and it's under the program, but I'm also working for the program as well. So here it opens up in which definitely looks like Monument Valley. The back of Monument Valley, not a lot of people see that area. And you could see an old hogan, a wood hogan. And this is the back of Monument Valley. You would have to take, you would have to pass the main attraction area. You have to go inside. And back here is very sandy. I've been here one summer for Dene Environmental Institute when I was an intern for that program. We went back here to check for a uranium mine, and we had to read the radiation as well. So this is what that area looks like, and it still looks the same. And I see that they're herding sheep and goats. Well, actually, it looks like they only have goats. So they have goats there, and I see a ram. And I was commenting earlier about that during that time it must have been really hot, especially in the sand dune and them herding sheep. I'm not sure what time of the year this is, but it looks like it's during then. And you can see that the horses are drinking water. It must look like it is during the summer, maybe towards the end of the summer. And I can see that the outfit the women are wearing, they're wearing velveteen, and which adds to the heat. I wonder if they're really hot during that time. And now it's opening about Navajo silversmith, and it's an interesting opening because it really has nothing to do with Navajo silversmithing, but oh well. And right here, they're under a cha'o. A cha'o is a shade house in Navajo. And right here is a casted buckle, all silver buckle. And right here, they're using tufa casts. They're doing tufa casting, and it's made out of tufa stones. And tufa stones is basically volcanic ash. And they use that because it's heat resistant enough to melt silver and cast silver in it. And it looks like they've casted what they call the horse bridle, where the Navajo it's called Najah, and it's the one that looks like the claw, and it's usually that represents, that design came originally from horses. And you can see that he's visiting. Oh, he's purchasing silver is what he's doing. That's a silver sheet that he has, and most likely he's going to use that. And he's probably going to use that silver to cast. And there's a wagon right here. So he's cutting the tufa stones right now. He's sawing the tufa stones, and these can get you really dusty and dirty. And I notice he's not wearing a mask because all the little particles can get to your lungs. So, and there's the first cut, and you can tell that it's not perfect. So what you have to do, you have to rub them together in order to get them leveled and straight, because if they're not straight and they're not flush with each other, your casting will not come out. There'll be air that comes in, and that's something that you don't want. And this is what he's doing, actually. He's making sure that it's leveled. And he's actually wearing a casted bracelet right now, probably something he made himself. And that's my favorite kind of jewelry, is casted jewelry. There's all different kinds of casting. There's also sand casting, Then there's also ingot casting. So right here, it's showing you how he pre-draws what he's gonna chisel out. And I notice that he's using just files. He's using his file set to chisel out his design. Because what I use when I cast is I use wood carving tools. Those work really well. See, it's almost perfect. And right here, right, what he's doing, he's making air lines on the side. Because air lines are usually what helps push the silver through. And I notice in the middle, those act as air lines too, because since he's making a picture frame type of buckle, he needs those two air lines for it to for the silver to flow throughout the whole thing. And he's tying it with leather, and you stand it up like that. And what he did before, he made sure that the both tufa stones are actually he heated both tufa stones with the flame, and that way that helps the silver flow better. And if you don't do that, the silver most likely will stick and it will not flow through. So that's what he was doing, and that's how you prep before you melt your silver and you cast. So right here, he's putting silver in the, what he's doing right now, he has a crucible right there, and he's melting the silver with his, it looks like a butane, and you can see that how the silver is, it's like a mirror-like, and you get it to that, and you pour it in like that. Then you let it cool for a bit, and then you untie it, and look at, that's a perfect casting. That is really nice. That is a really nice cast. And you can see, he cuts off the top ends right here. And that's how I found out that he used that, the middle parts, so it can flow better. And here's a filing stage. Filing stage is very important in silversmithing. It takes away a lot of the imperfections, and it's one of the crucial steps in silversmithing. You can tell when someone doesn't file right, or if someone doesn't file at all. You can really tell in that. And then he's sanding down the backing, and he's doing that so he can clean the back of the buckle, because because he's going to solder the back, that strip in the back. Because solder will only flow and stick, silver solder will only flow and stick if the surface is clean. So that's what he's doing right now. He's soldering the back of it. And he's filing again. There's going to be a lot of filing in that wool silversmithing. You can see he finished that. And that was a before. And you can see the little air lines on there. And that's what helps push the silver out too. And now he's back in the mountain. This is probably... Oh, yep. This is Kindkel Trading Post, Wide Ruins. And he's at the trading post. And he's probably going to be trading his jewelry. Yep. He's trading his jewelry for, most likely for goods. Because back then, Navajo people didn't think much. They didn't use currency. They didn't use... dollar bills or coins, and if they did get coins, like silver dollar or copper, they would actually turn those into jewelry. They use those silver dollar. They would often put that, or they would melt it, or they would also put it, implement it into their jewelry. They never used it. So every time they made trades at trading posts, it was mostly for goods, for food for their livestock. And so right here, you see four bracelets. And these ones, one of them is only, one of them is casted actually. The others are made these are made just a normal way. And these come with stones. And the one on the left is actually a casted bracelet. And actually the right one looks casted as well. The right one looks casted, it's just that in the middle there are stones and the silver beads as well. You can tell when a piece of jewelry is casted because it has a texture on it. And you can tell when it's tufa casted or sand casted. There's ways to tell the difference on those. Interesting designs, especially the left bracelet. Wonder what he was trying to go for. See right here, he also stamped the bracelet on the sides, so you can see the stamping. This one is interesting. I never seen a bracelet like this before. And then right here, you can see the najah that I was talking about, kind of like the claw. The one in the middle is what we call a najah. And a lot of our jewelry, our Navajo jewelry, has this design in a lot of our necklaces, earrings, bracelets, and it originally came from the horse bridle, and that's where the influence came from. And you can see right now where it usually goes on the horse, kind of on their forehead actually. And so this is a well-known design, a well-known silversmithing design that a lot of our people use even to this day. This is a nice bridle. And here's another casted bow guard. And then that's the same thing. Look at how perfect this belt is, this concho. And it's all handmade, and he hand carved this buckle out, and this is really amazing. It's really perfect. And again, it ends with the goats with the same people. And you can see the little girl enjoying her sightseeing. This is probably somewhere that she always goes because it looks like a trail for their goat herding. And she's wearing a tziyel and her outfit too. And she's just sitting there overlooking. You can see Monument Valley in the background, way in the background, way in the back on top left. And there it is. So Navajo silversmithing. That was really nice to see. I learned something from that too, especially about the picture frame on how you could get the silver to flow. You just have to make two lines in the middle. So, but yeah. Thank you.
Yat'e, this is Rhiannon Sorrell at Salie, Arizona, and I am viewing the film Arts and Crafts of the Southwest Indians Part 1, The Navajos, which was filmed primarily near Pine Springs in 1940. The title here can be a little misleading because it makes the trades in this film sound like recreational more of a recreational pastime rather than a way of life that has sustained the Diné since the early 20th century, and it continues to play an important role in contemporary life and economics on the Navajo Nation. As you can see from these opening scenes, the Diné were not village-dwelling and lived in small bands spaced apart from each other and often far away from the nearest town. This is where trading posts came in hand. The one shown here is Pine Springs Trading Post, which operated as one of the many community hubs that also functioned much like a grocery store, an arts and crafts store, a bank, a post office, sometimes even family courts when justices could not, or the people couldn't move to towns to hold court sessions. They also functioned even as mortuaries, particularly this place as well, until it closed in 1971. The man shown in the foreground is referred to in the video and identified as Sam Begay. Sam Begay was one of many Navajo silversmiths whose peak production of arts and crafts jewelry was back in 1940. Here, Mr. Begay looks for sandstone to create the mold for his belt buckle piece. Using sandstone as a mold was one way to cast jewelry. Others included using tufa, which is a type of limestone, and the other was sand casting, for which many Native or Navajo silversmiths are famous even today. Before casting, many of the designs were stamped, hammered, or twisted into the silver. As you can see right now, Sam drawing, the designs can be drawn and carved into the mold. Although it was and still is a time-consuming process, traders often allowed artists to take as much time as they needed with their work because the quality of the finished product mattered much more than the quantity produced. Casting also became more popular as silver became more available at the trading posts. Before, in the old days, silversmiths used to melt down silver dollars from coins in the U.S. and before that, some Mexican coins, in order to make their jewelry. The small bits of silver were usually only enough to make small pieces like buttons and thin bracelets, but now that they're more available, they're able to produce larger pieces of jewelry, such as the one that Sam is making here. Whereas men were known for their silversmithing, the women are known for their weaving. The woman shown here with her husband is Irene Yazzie. Her husband is referred to as Luke Yazzie. Irene Yazzie is actually the subject of a famous photograph by Laura Gilpin, who was known for her photographs of Navajo and Pueblo people, and of the Southwest landscape in general. You can see her picking herbs and bringing them back home to make the dyes. Traditional Navajo weaving made use of local herbs and plants in order to make the dye. My own grandmother blended different ratios of black, white, and brown wool in order to make a range of grays and browns. Because of this, a lot of her rugs and rugs that were produced from her area and era have more of an earth tone color to them, and they're sometimes referred to as the two gray heels design. And it wasn't long before the trading post started stocking commercial dyes, and some weavers experimented with new pigments. It's really interesting in the scene how she's weaving standing up. The looms I've seen can be adjusted so that the finished product can be rolled down and under large poles or a pipe as the project progresses. Other methods of keeping level with the progressing work was to stack chairs high enough so that the weaver could always be seated as the same level of the work. This shot with the group of women here really shows how much of an effort it takes to even get to the weaving part of making a rug. We used to help my grandmother with the carding, which is depicted here, which is the combing of the wool. But that was usually all we helped with, because spinning, which is shown in the next scene, was really something that was best left to the experts, since it was such a delicate process, and us kids just ended up making threads of varying thicknesses, which, you know, grandma had to go and fix all over again in the end anyway. So oftentimes it was just a wasted effort. Sometimes she helped let us help set up the loom, as was depicted in the previous scene, making the figure eights around between the two ends of the rug. In this next shot, they're getting ready to go to the trading post. Not much has changed since that time and this time with regard to traveling long distances in order to do business. Most people travel to border towns such as Gallup, Flagstaff, or Farmington in order to do their major shopping. And this usually takes at least a couple of hours of traveling by vehicle. So going to town is usually an all-day event, which is depicted here. People still rely on trading post establishments, especially for pawn services, since banks don't usually deal with small loans. So they still rely on pawn in order to get their quick emergency cash. If you see in this scene, there's two men hanging around outside the trading post. It really wasn't uncommon for people to make overnight trips to the trading post in order to catch up with friends and distant family members. As I said earlier, the trading posts were community hubs where news and gossip were exchanged, in addition to the business transactions that took place there. As you can see in the video, there's some but not a whole lot of cash has changed hands, and this is because the trading posts usually dealt in credit and bartering of goods rather than in cash. Irene's giving her rug to the trader. The narrator identifies the trader shown here as Sammy Day, a half Navajo Indian trader. The Day family were Anglo-Indian traders who operated out of the Eastern Navajo Nation. Sammy Day Sr. died in 1925, before this video was produced, and Sammy Day Jr. is said to have been a U.S. Deputy Marshal. And there's no mention of the family marrying into the Navajo tribe, so I'm not really sure who exactly is the trader depicted here. Here we see the plane landing carrying the so-called trader from Window Rock. Just to give an idea of how rural Pine Springs is and was, It still takes roughly an hour to get to Pine Springs from Window Rock by car, even though the most direct route is only about 30 miles. So you can imagine how much of a journey it would have been by wagon back in these days. The Navajo Arts and Crafts Enterprise, which is now based in Window Rock, was established in 1941. At the time, however, it was called the Navajo Arts and Crafts Guild and was based in Fort Wingate before changing the name in 1972 and moving to Window Rock. These guilds don't always offer pond service or the full range of services that the trading post did, but they were helpful in getting artists and getting their work recognized and distributed among a wider audience.